What happens when you combine the most innovative, eccentric, and charismatic leaders, disruptors, and founders from tech with the pedigree and history of one of the most established institutions within the City of London? Season 4 of the Searching for Mana podcast will be produced in partnership with the London Stock Exchange and will represent one of the most exciting collaborations in the tech space. Anatoly, welcome onto Searching for Mana.
Awesome to be here. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you on the show. Been looking forward to this, been in the diary for a while. I suppose you're busy.
A little bit, yeah. I think working on a decentralized permissionless blockchain is definitely like five different jobs at the same time.
It, by nature, it is, and we'll cut into that. I assume a lot of the audience may well know you and may well know what Solana's up to, but if you could be so kind to set the scene, please.
So Solana is an open, public, permissionless blockchain, very similar in idea to Ethereum. It's a smart contract platform, so it runs applications. And it's, I think, the third most decentralized now if you measure by number of nodes or Nakamoto coefficient or some objective metrics that you can start poking at these networks. I think we're in the third now. And what's cool about it is that it does more transactions from applications than all the other chains combined. So to give you some random numbers, Solana is about 30 million application transactions per day. Binance Smart Chain, which is the second largest, does about 3. And then Ethereum does about 1. And then a lot of the new chains do around 1 to 2. And then there's a steep drop off.
And would that be because of the technicalities of how the chain works, or like literally those metrics are fair in terms of the volume of use?
So these don't represent human users. Like the kind of thing that we suspected, and this should be obvious intuitively, is that like once you reduce the cost of using the systems to be much, much cheaper, Solana is 1/100th of a penny. So which is 100 times cheaper than everyone else. You get into territory where it's cheap enough for machines to use. And then applications that like use machines communication over these networks start taking over. So, you know, humans are not going to be the dominant thing that uses blockchains in the future. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. So on Solana, about 20 million of those come from like market makers. So these are like financial automated systems that are providing liquidity and doing all sorts of finance stuff. It's over my head. I'm just a systems engineer, but it's pretty obvious that once you build something that is really, really cheap, people will start finding ways to like add their business, automated business processes to use it.
I was talking to a PhD candidate yesterday. So Mana Lab is sponsoring research and development into the future of work and within blockchain. And they were really intrigued around if you bring IoT, AI, and blockchain together, just how actually autonomous, you know, organizations could work in maybe the next couple of years. Have you seen anything that shows that it could go that way on Solana?
I think the Helium announcement is maybe the most obvious example of that. So there's a proposal in the Helium community to move to basically drop support for their layer one, because it's a lot of work to build a layer one blockchain, and to use Solana as the platform for that and do all their coordination of their, you know, 100,000 IoT devices on it.
Amazing. And you were just talking about what in essence, from a user case perspective, is bringing such a large, whether it's technical use or human use, to the Solana platform. You know, for the audience, if they could visualize something that you're really excited about, one of the user cases right now that's got traction, and perhaps something that a consumer could relate to.
Yeah, so Solana is also, I think, number one in terms of actual humans using it too, from what we can tell. So how we track this, and it's really, really hard to figure out if these are real humans or not, but at least this is a common across all chains. We look at unique signers That means people with self-custody that have generated their own public key that generate a signature. The reason for that is because it's kind of pointless to generate more than one public key for an automated process. Market makers and all these things that talk to smart contracts, there's no benefit and there's quite a lot more headache to use more than one key. So that's kind of a pretty good estimate. So we see, I think we had peak over 1.5 million of daily active signers. And this is between all the applications. And to despite us tagging Solana's blockchain and NASDAQ speed and really focusing on this financial use case, the use case that actually blew up in terms of users was NFTs. And this was surprising to, I think, all of us. Like, we really didn't expect it. But it kind of makes sense that that would be true because, you know, I think everyone benefits from a cheaper and faster, more reliable blockchain. So if you get it to work for something like Serum, which is a NASDAQ style exchange with an order books and things like that, it means that it's surviving probably the hardest problem you can ever try to get to work in a blockchain. And that means it's good enough for just about every consumer application out there. So we saw a massive explosion of artists, creative folks start launching NFTs. I think it's over 20 million NFTs that have been launched on Solana. We see days where it's, you know, weeks where it's 500,000 over a weekend, which is pretty wild. And that's a really kind of a exciting use case for me. I grew up like in the internet in the 90s. So I was there like the early 90s days. And I remember bulletin boards and all these like really micro communities just forming on the web around memes, the kind of early internet culture that you see now with NFTs. It's exactly the same. It's just folks having fun, generating memes, jokes, being silly. And that led to something like Facebook, which was, I think, worth close to $1 trillion. So in 1994, there's no way anybody would have convinced me that something from bulletin boards is going to be worth nearly $1 trillion 20 years from now. And similarly, you look at these NFTs and you think this is all jokes. There's no way this is serious. But I am pretty confident that like if the next Marvel, the next Disney is going to be built, it's probably being built right now. There's probably an NFT community that's figuring out the stories, the lore, the branding, the way to scale it globally and kind of build those like next great big companies.
We just had the CEO of SoundCloud on Searching for Mana. And he was talking about, you know, if you go back a few years ago, really, the likes of SoundCloud was, you know, bringing out artists who at the beginning of their careers, like if it's drops in like Berlin of electro musicians, whereas what he's starting to see the opportunity there and in the space is exactly like you say, like the next Disney is going to be built on these platforms where the onus is in the hands of the creator. So Anatoly, like across many chains, and we've had quite a lot of the founders or the architects, or individuals from the chains on the show, most people have had a lot of their traction with NFTs and different people are looking at it differently. Just to set like the question up, you've got lots and lots of people creating NFT digital art, PFPs, whatever it might be, on one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum, you start to see, you know, digital galleries that are quite curated coming out where they're really trying to either convert original high-end, top-end art into NFT artists, or perhaps it's just the current best artists that exist. Now, that's very different, and it depends what I think your style is and how you engage the community. So Tezos has done quite well in the NFT space, and you could literally go through the different chains and kind of start thinking there's a different culture to the art. You know, how much do you want to create the style of NFTs on Solana? You don't want to at all? How are you looking at it? How are you marketing?
I couldn't even do it. There's no way we could control it. That's like the weird part. Like it exploded so quickly with so many artists and that it really went all over in every direction. We had like, there were, I think, close to a dozen different NFT marketplaces that boomed and busted on Solana until like basically Magic Eden and Exchange Art like established themselves. But there were tons of microcycles, and the one use case that really stuck out was the profile picture one, which is kind of the, you know, the Bored Apes, the CryptoPunks, what folks mostly, I think, outside of crypto may have heard of. Those are the very dominant ones. And the folks that are building them, I think, initially were just messing around. Like, they just released something because they thought they could make cool art for fun on the internet. But now you start really seeing them, new teams or some of the original teams, just become much more serious about what they're doing and really try to figure out how to take this kind of raw energy of a decentralized community that is a bit of a free-for-all and like build within that and build something bigger. So that, I think, is like the really exciting part.
And if, you know, you can't, as I understand, really, and by its nature, you don't want to, you know, control it at all, what do you have a responsibility for? And just to tease the question a little bit, I mean, I think at different points, people have probably said to me, like, you know, is Solana the one? I mean, Solana is just absolutely popping, right? You know, and in so many different ways, so many different metrics, you can completely justify that. And then, you know, I mean, ad hoc, but recently there's been some outages. And then if we think about those NFT artists, those communities, you know, they're relying on the fact that they're not going to lose assets and so on and so forth. So, you know, could you talk to that, please?
Absolutely. So the key thing that makes this whole system work, or any of these blockchains, is that you never lose the data. Like, you never lose the state. This is why you kind of can think of it as a database that nobody owns, is that there's so many copies of it. And Solana, it's 3,500 different replicas. It's hard to tell which ones are controlled by independent parties, but you assume if that's kind of similar across networks, you can kind of compare it. So it's 5,000 to 6,000 on Ethereum, but 10,000 to 12,000 on Bitcoin. And Solana is the third largest one. So the probability of all of these pieces of data getting corrupted at the same time is virtually zero. And this is where that core decentralization piece comes from. Now, the reliability thing, that's the challenge, is like, how do you make the system massively decentralized with a lot of copies, really, really fast and cheap, because we already have slow versions of that, and then also reliable. And that third one has been the biggest challenge for us, because really focused on the first two, and I think kicked a lot of butt there. I think it's pretty, nobody's going to argue that there's a cheaper, faster chain than Solana right now. On decentralization, we're getting really close to, like, we're over 60% of Ethereum. I think we can probably pass them.
Anatoly, for the first two that you prioritized and benefits came from that, is for the reliability in the third one, is it possible to rectify that?
Yeah, so the kind of bugs that we've seen are engineering bugs. So these are like memory leaks or software, like, you know, coding errors. The biggest thing that's like the most massive change that's happening is that there's a separate team now implementing a different implementation from the ground up of the Solana validator called Firedancer. And this is built by Jump Crypto. Now, the reason for this is the same reason why, like, when NASA sends a space shuttle, they have the same computer controller built by two different companies. They literally have five different versions of the exact same technology on the shuttle, because if one fails, then they hope that the other one survives. And this is kind of the same principle, as you want redundancy in the implementation. Because when you have a system this complex with so many people working on it, bugs will happen, not intentionally. There's audits, there's testing, there's massive amounts of testing on test node and warm-up period. But this is still software built by humans. So the best thing you can do is add redundancy. So this redundant client, the probability of the same bug occurring in two clients at the same time built by different teams becomes virtually zero. That's the biggest change. It's a long-term change. In the near term, if folks that have been using and following Solana, you saw massive improvement from 1.9 to 1.10 release. And this is like, as an engineer, like, when we saw these problems happening, we have a better version that's in testnet. It just, like, it's like a gut punch, because there's nothing really we can do to accelerate moving the software from the testnet to mainnet, because it has to go through audits. has to go through our reliability testing on the test net. And then we hope that the bugs that we think we fixed are actually fixed, but we don't know until it lands. So you're just kind of stuck doing your best, and like all everything we could do to patch the system while it was running, we did. But the major changes with 1.10, I think folks have seen, has been awesome. We've seen days where Solana processed over 6,000 TPS. So like there's been like massive NFT drops and things like that that the network has handled.
Yep.
And the next release is even better. So that kind of iterative process time is basically on our side, and you've seen the performance improve. But I'm really excited about the true like kind of redundancy that we can add to the system with a separate team. Now, what's cool about that team is that this is the hardware engineering and software team from Jump, which is a market maker. They do high frequency trading. Our internal target was getting this network to demonstrate that it can handle 1 gigabit worth of transactions. Their target is 10 gigabits, which is in theory, millions of transactions per second. If they can demonstrate that in a lab environment, then we get it to mainnet, commercialize it, get everybody to upgrade. And I think it's kind of downhill from there.
Thanks for speaking so transparently through all of that. I really respect that. Now, you hinted at earlier on that, you know, you were very much going after probably the financial market. And then it's much like in a really incredibly much smaller way. I had a business focused on fintech, and then fintech took us into blockchain, and then blockchain can take you everywhere, you know, gaming, art, et cetera, et cetera. It's super exciting. But at some time, you know, you come back to, should I stay focused? You know, should we go and potentially win a category? And a lot of the chains are thinking through this. How are you thinking through that?
So I'm an operating systems geek. I love building tools for other devs. And this has been like our core focus. We wanted a use case to build for, because you kind of need like a lighthouse example. You can't just build a platform, because what is it for? Well, like it's for everything. If it's for everything, it's for nothing. So the one thing that we really focused on was this idea of running a central limit order book style exchange as a smart contract. And a lot of folks thought that that was impossible, because the only examples that they saw were things like Uniswap that are constant function market makers. But in our tests, we could demonstrate that, look, we can actually build it and make it work. And as we were building the network, that was our benchmark. And this is where, in those early days, right when we launched, I got connected to Sam from FTX. And we had like a bunch of late night phone calls, and kind of we just mind melded in this idea that the thing that's blocking massive adoption is still performance and latency and all the hardware stuff. And if we can solve those problems, then I think you can unlock a bunch of new use cases. And I got really excited about that and incubated Serum, which is, again, people thought that this was going to just not work. Like there's no way the technology could support it, but clearly like we are able to support Serum. Serum itself does more transactions than all the other blockchains combined. And we are able to do that while increasing the decentralization. So when we launch it, like 40 nodes right now, there's close to 2,000 validators and like 3,500 like full nodes altogether. So none of those things are blockers, like technology blockers. When people try to imagine like, why can't blockchain do this or that? Like we've actually proven that it can. So I'm pretty excited about that. And because we were able to demonstrate that there's a new technology that runs like a new thing that wasn't possible before, that actually brought a lot of devs across every other use case. And we got to focus on what we really wanted, which is building an awesome platform, awesome operating system, just get as many people building on it. And, you know, like kind of our goal is that, like, we don't know what that magic use case is going to be that onboards the next, you know, 100 million people to self-custody. But we see that there's a huge rush of really smart folks leaving their jobs at Google, at Meta, whatever, and starting companies in crypto. So we want to unblock them. We want to give them the best tech possible and kind of get them going.
Yeah, I love it. I think that's a really good intro across a bunch of the stuff that you're looking at the moment. So thanks for that. We're going to, in the final part of the show, come back to a few things. We'll talk about Sago, which is the mobile phone that Solana have put out, I think on top of Android, which is super exciting. I also want to talk about the venture fund that you guys have recently raised. We had Amy Wu from FTX Ventures on the show recently. So I know that you guys obviously relatively close, as you just say, you're like close with Sam, and we have Brett Harrison on the show, the US president as well. So I'm super interested to see what you're looking to do with that fund. Now we'll go into some of Anatoly's background. So to start with, we're just going to go through the searching for Mana round, and you feel free to just yes, no, or as long form answer any of these as possible. Okay. Cool. So if you were to, which I mean, you probably have, or you're definitely going to have the front cover of Forbes or whatever magazine you really vibe, what would be the message that you would put onto it?
Oh man. I don't know. I guess that it makes me uncomfortable to think that I would be like that center of attention. It's kind of never really thought of that. Yeah.
That's never bothered Sam Bankman-Fried, has it?
Yeah. Yeah. He's a different character. I'm more of a engineer, you know, like an individual contributor was my role basically in every company I worked at. So I don't know. That's a tough question.
But I'll force your hand here. So asking it that way around to try and think, you know, do you think there's something that's really powerful for most people to read about?
Yeah. You know, I would love to see that, you know, this technology that we're working on brings something to the world that's a real change. I always like kind of, when I first looked at DAOs and the Constitution DAO, I had this idea that like, well, you know, there was only 40,000 people that participated there. What if it was like 40 million? Could 40 million people decide to like buy every coal plant in the world and shut them down? Could you actually increase the amount of coordination and like actual human decision-making power and make it faster and more decisive, right? And like just get shit done. I'd love to see that being like, you know, every coal plant is shut down by a DAO on Solana as the cover of Forbes. That would be awesome.
Just be like it could just be like shut shit down and then like the QR code to your DAO.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. What if anything keeps you up at night?
Safety. So the biggest risk to all these blockchains, especially the new ones that only have one client, is that there's some catastrophic bug there that causes a massive corruption to the state. And these are like, yeah, these are just stomach churning. It's like, you know, when you hear of a bug, a smart contract bug that hundreds of millions of dollars are lost, this is that, but an X squared. So that's the biggest fear.
Is there a book that you would like to recommend to the audience?
A book? Oh man, it's been a while. Oh, man, I haven't read a ton of fun stuff in a while, but I've been listening to this Revolutions podcast on Spotify. Oh, this guy, Mike Duncan, that goes the Roman history one, I listened to like back to back almost, like 80 hours or something. And the Revolutions one as well. And it just kind of goes into the detail of the characters. He's not like a dramatic person. He just really sticks to the storylines, but you get like such a sense of the personalities that drove a lot of these things. And it's just wild. It's stranger than fiction. You know, there's no way you could even write it.
Yeah. It makes history so much more fascinating. I listened to I think it's the Bankless podcast recently. And there was a historian who's now a venture capitalist on talking about the Renaissance period. And, you know, kind of saying that we're chiming that era right now, which seems like it might be true. And the way that he could tell the stories and take you there was just absolutely amazing. We'll share the link to that podcast. It sounds great. Is there any particular ritual that you have, you know, in the morning to get you prepared for the day?
I usually go on a bike ride, so I like to do like a you know about an hour uphill if I can.
Wow, every morning about an hour uphill, that's mental.
Yeah, well, you
yeah,
can only go half. You can only go half of the time uphill. You got to go back eventually.
And do you do that with any aim to it? Do you enter certain cycling events, or you just love?
I was a terrible triathlete at one point. Like, I've done like an Ironman, but like a very slow one. But since the startup, and like just had zero time to actually do anything serious.
And then last one before the mana question, we always ask everybody we're searching for mana who the next guest might be. So I'd like to ask you for who you would recommend to come on to Searching for Mana for the audience to listen to. Before doing that, just so you know, I asked Oleg, who's the founder and CEO of Sweatcoin, who to get on the show, and he named you after that bastard went on the Near Protocol. Can you believe it? Anything to say to Oleg?
Near guys are awesome. I love those guys. So I think we're so early in the space that no one is like really in this backstabbing competitive mood.
Yeah, I mean, it is nice to see. In a few years, we'll come back to that. But okay, cool. Who would you recommend to come on the Searching for Mana show?
I think... some of the folks that are awesome from the, I'll say from the Ethereum community, Dunkrad Faced, if you know who he is, he's awesome. Yeah. Ethereum engineer. If you want to know the insides and outs of Ethereum and where it's going, he would be like one of the best people to have on the show.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I'd love that. We literally had very little from Ethereum. So I'll tap you up for that intro. Thank you. So Searching for Mana show, mana in gaming is the magic. So you've got power, you know, your life, and then the mana is, you know, can you run really quick? Can you jump high? You know, you've got great sword skills. And I tell you, what would you say your mana is?
Coding, I guess. Yeah. That I'm pretty good at that. I wish I was a better cyclist. If I could like
but you're saying yours is coding. So like on your mana card, you've got coding, but like give it the layer beyond that as well.
Like how many points I have? Like
are you top 18? Level? Top level Rust.
Yeah, top level, yeah, programming. And then I think steep fall after that.
Amazing. Thank you so much. So I'd like you to set the scene for the audience as far back as you'd like to go, and please go back as early as possible, and really give us some type of idea about perhaps really early influences. And if any of those relate to, you know, then, you know, you becoming a coder or an entrepreneur.
Yeah. So, my family emigrated, like we were refugees from the Soviet Union in 92. So it was like, I was a kid, 11 years old in Chicago, and my parents got me a computer. And the internet was just basically starting, right? This was like a Pentium 75 when running Windows 95. And I had like a browser, and there's barely anything worked, but, this is when I got into computers, and I, you know, had some other nerdy friends in school that were into Linux and like coding. There was a software class there, and I wasn't actually even thinking about it as a career, but I was interested in it. And I ended up at Urbana-Champaign and met some more friends that wanted to do a startup. So we started building voice over IP systems. This is like Google Grand Central Dispatch or Google Voice, but 2001, 2002, and like .com crash happened. We were in central Illinois, and we had no clue about venture capital or anything like that. We were trying to bootstrap this thing, and it kind of petered out after we graduated, but I got hired at Qualcomm because they were building basically the exact same thing. So I already built the system once. So they basically hired me on the spot. And ended up...
How early was that? Like how many people
2003. Were
there? And you entered the company at what type of phase was it in?
Qualcomm was in, they were already a big company. So it was like 13,000 folks at least. So it was like a big chip manufacturer, right? Like with, I think CDMA had already been broken out and they started working on the next versions of it. This was post crash. So the job market at that time wasn't great. My advisors were actually telling me like at school that maybe computer science is not a great career track. And had I like been a bit more ambitious, I think we could have taken our tech and gone to Silicon Valley and like really had that kind of drive to build something like Google Voice. That would have, I think, succeeded. But, you know, we were kids. And when I was interviewing at Qualcomm, everyone was wearing board shorts and flip-flops. And it was right by the beach in San Diego. It's pretty irresistible. So I did end up living literally in Solana Beach with some friends of mine, some of them that were at that startup at UIUC with me. And we would bike, we would wake up, surf, bike to work, bike back, surf again, then go play underwater hockey. I can get into that if you want to, but that was kind of our lifestyle. The cool thing though, working at Qualcomm, is that we were there from the days when we started, things were flip phones. So 2 megabyte screens, two inch screens, 2 megabyte devices. And then my last project, I was on a lead in the advanced technologies group. We were building like DSP filters for augmented reality and a handheld supercomputer basically. So you in like a span of a decade, you saw like a literal 1000x improvement in technology, which is really, really kind of hard to fathom.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. Whilst you're doing that, because I want to like lean a little bit into how you're thinking about things at that point. And by the way, there's different extremes of this. Some people just are like, I'm having a great time, I'm naturally motivated, I'm super curious, and others might have some type of strategy. You know, you've set something up. It was obviously in the dot-com crash. And then you end up in a situation where it's still really interesting work. And it's with like, you know, a bunch of people where you're having a great time. But are you strategic at that point? Are you thinking like, you know, I'm hell-bent at some point to go and found something and for it to be as big as Google? Or are you just switched off at this point? Like, how are you thinking?
No, I had like... it's almost like a disease, right? You kind of, I had like always a side project on the side, and some had were VR experiments, I built like a bunch of deep learning models, trying to and apply them to like trading and options trading and stuff like that. And this was always like, none of them had like a traction, right? And none of them were, like ideas that were the in a new market that was like growing rapidly. And this is something that was quite different about when I had the like I'm gonna go do a blockchain thing. My wife actually just like pushed me to like, okay, if you're gonna do this, the market is so hot right now that this opportunity is maybe 6 months, that's it. And like if you wait and like to go start something or when it's convenient for you, you're probably never going to get it off the ground unless you go do it right now. So that was like a decision, a forced decision that like I had to make.
That's around like 2017.
Yeah.
And your wife's prophecy was relatively correct if we look at when then chain stopped really coming out, right?
Yeah. So if basically I think we caught the tail end of the 2017 bull market to raise our seed round, and had we been like, I think a month later, it wouldn't have happened.
How did you, thanks for talking us through that. And then how did you, with others decide to go rally and ultimately achieve that raise? Like tell us the story of the actual founding and getting that first check.
One of those side projects that never amounted to anything in 2017 was we were building, a friend of mine also became a co-founder, we were building deep learning hardware for deep learning, because this is what we were interested in. But it's a bunch of GPUs. So while they were not doing deep learning jobs, they were mining crypto. And it literally had like tea, coffees, and a beer at a Cafe Soleil in San Francisco. And that didn't sit with me. And I had this eureka moment that there's a different way to use the proof of mining algorithm. Instead of measuring entropy, you can measure time. And that kind of just triggered my brain to think about all those wireless protocols 2G, TDMA, CDMA, LTE, they all use time division multiple access to optimize how nodes communicate in a network, how transmitters communicate over wireless. Very similar problem.
And so like, I'm taking a few things from this. One is two coffees and one beer. It's an interesting combination. And then you've had this eureka moment. Now, how to translate that to somebody who's going to invest in you, and how did you do that?
So first person I had to convince was my wife, which she's an engineer as well. And she was able to like, okay, once she's still done with me, and that she's kind of like, okay, this could work. And the market is so hot right now, you really need to take a serious swing at it. So lucky for her, I just decided to take her advice seriously. And so I play the sport called underwater hockey, and there's a group in Menlo Park that plays. And any group big enough in San Francisco always has some, you know, some folks that are in venture capital. And those two folks that I talked to were literally like, never had this happen to me and any other idea that I pitched to anyone in my life. And I had a lot of stupid ideas or ideas that I thought were good, but literally on a handshake, they're like, sure, I'm in. The market is so hot right now, I don't really care what you're building. But if it's crypto and it's you, I'm in for like small checks, 25, 50K. But to me, that was a massive amount of money. Like when you're thinking about like as an engineer, even one that's has a great salary out of a big tech firm, quitting your job means you're no longer have that salary to pay for your mortgage, for your healthcare. And if you do have somebody that backs you with like 25, 50K, that's 6 months of runway. And me as like a engineer, I'm like, okay, I can get a lot of shit done in 6 months. If I can actually build a ton of stuff and prototype and MVP and prove out a lot of things. So this is actually a massive amount of like investment. Doesn't seem like a lot, but that was enough for me to like basically be fully committed. And through a friend of mine, I met Raj, who's the co-founder CEO of Solana. And he has raised before, has been in venture capital. And at that time, he was kind of in between things. He just left Amada Health. And he was like, okay, I'll see if I can help you for 6 months, like see if we can raise our seed round. And then once we got that seed round together, I was able to just convince a bunch of super senior folks at Qualcomm, like 10 plus years folks with that I worked with. I think the best people that I've ever worked with. My boss, literally one of my managers and leads in my career, was like one of our first employees to join me. And we had, I think, built probably the most technical like team with the most depth in crypto in that very short amount of time. So it became very real as soon as we were able to get those hires.
So you've got a bunch of nice trends there. Diego, who built Anchorage, which is a phenomenal firm, and he's incredible, had literally worked for almost a decade with his co-founder before in two different companies. And they'd had the idea that they were going to found something. They didn't know what, but they knew they wanted to work with each other.
Diego interviewed me at Docker at one point.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What happened?
This was that 2017 era where I was bouncing from Bezosphere to another company, and I interviewed at Docker, and Diego interviewed me, and I thought it was like, you know, it was pretty good, but I was like, I decided to pick a different company for whatever reason. Luckily, right? Like it all worked out, but it's just really funny. We had like always like a great relationship after that, just kept in touch.
He's incredible. I mean, that guy on his Mana card has just got security at the top. He loves it. And so it's with you there, there's a few interesting, I know there'll be many, but there's a few interesting things, which is, you know, you had this ability to draw on this team who would have seen how you'd behaved working previously and obviously understood. I mean, this is a highly credible person to go at this. But then also because you had this underwater hockey, is it? Hockey, which we can
exactly
go into.
What it sounds like.
We can go into the end. You know, you had this scenario where these venture capitalists, you know, had probably built some rapport with you and knew how great you are technically and thought, okay, yeah, the space is super hot. So we walk into an era now where, you know, talent is more distributed out of Silicon Valley. And those serendipitous moments, those water cooler moments, perhaps in, you know, IRL, in real life, are less. How does that happen online for entrepreneurs now?
Yeah, so we've tried to kind of manufacture this a bit. So we have these, we started running this Hacker House program and hackathons, and it's been, I don't know if it's COVID that people are starving for in real contact, but it's just been massively successful. I think tens of thousands of people literally have gone to the, registered and gone to the Hacker Houses. The Bangalore event had like 3,000 people show up. Our last hackathon had 14,000 registrations, and people just form teams, and they form teams, they build product, and those products get funding in the span of a hackathon. Like literally, like we've never talked to each other and we never met before, but we had been able to like establish that rapport and like get stuff done. I think that part is like not as good, I think, as like a long-term relationship with somebody that you worked with like for a decade. And I think we'll see what happens like in the future, but with distributed teams. But I think as folks become more comfortable being distributed, they'll actually become more comfortable trusting each other online too.
Yeah, I'm talking to different organizations, but within communities. And that's not always just because they're on the chain, but there are these affiliations. Like let's say in Web3, there's three major ones. And trying to see how they can be productive and creative in different organizations and not kind of waste the time on all doing the same thing. And so there's a lot of tooling around this in DAOs at the moment, and it's very early on. But just my interest in cultures and productivity and creativity, I think that at the moment it's tricky, but I think it will get better. Like you say, I mean, the hackathons are super energetic, super exciting. Founders will come together. You've got, you know, brilliant venture funding from DAOs right now, but that capital is huge and it can get distributed very quickly. You've got massive grants being put out in Web3. Just all needs to get a little bit more sophisticated as we go along. So just to finish this section, so you founded it, you know, you've got the check that allowed you to do the damage you can coding in 6 months. And then obviously, you know, the rest is history, but perhaps you'd like to like talk about a particular moment where you realized, okay, I've got it. You know, I've had the eureka moment. I've somehow managed to get this funding. I've pulled a team together. And then when's the moment where you're like, oh my God, like look at the people coming to this.
Oh man, I think, I think the when I really finally was able to look up has been like, I would say recently, is after kind of the NFTs exploded on Solana, is that we saw a real uncontainable, like just rush of creators and businesses and things that we just didn't expect. And things like Magic Eden are kind of mind blowing. It's a web company that basically has content on it. That content isn't any that much different than content on Instagram. And at one point their like revenue run rate was like $1 billion, right? That's a lot of revenue. And none of that revenue comes from the ad exchange model, which is what dominated the web for the like 20 years. So this is excluding that entire ad loop where they steal your data, vectorize you, sell it. Like all that stuff doesn't exist there. It's purely self-generated, user-generated content that's digitally owned with like true self-custody and truly owned. And they're just running a marketplace for it. And it's a really wild thing to think that that could be a viable alternative to the web. And that's pretty transformative. Like,
yeah, so it's so exciting. I mean, there's so much written and so much content about, you know, the negative elements that have come from social media. And it's easy to forget that there's some huge positives that come from it. But nonetheless, the way that data was used for advertising, obviously, overall hasn't been something that's great. And so if we can replicate the ability for these communities to be able to do the positive elements without the negative, then we're into a really exciting space. So that takes me on to, I'm talking about some of the exciting stuff you're working on right now. So I wanted to talk to you about Solana Saga. So this is unbelievable. When I read that you guys were bringing out a mobile phone, I was immediately super curious about what the thinking there was. So how long have you been working on this? How's it going so far? And just talk us through what the rationale is, please.
Yeah, this started, I would say, at the start of this year, basically. I met Jason, who's the founder of Awesome. And I really, as soon as I started building crypto and thinking about like how do wallets work, my initial gut reaction was that the mobile device has the secure hardware to store seed phrases and to sign securely. That should be your day-to-day hardware wallet. Now, that's different from a cold storage, like, but your daily driver for like almost everything you do for normal people should be the phone. And the reason for that is because the seed phrase that holds your assets has to be kept securely, and you can't trust it to applications, not simply because the applications are bad, but because as wallets get more complex, as the kind of media that they handle gets more complicated and the applications that they interact with become more complicated, it's just more and more code. You have to have that seed phrase stored somewhere in an environment that all that code cannot possibly leak it for any reason. The only way to do that, or the smart way to do it, is to use the same hardware that's used for biometrics for your fingerprint scanner, your face ID on your iPhone or on your Android device. So that just naturally felt like the right thing. And Awesome was working on a privacy phone, and we kind of mind melded. And I think it's a pretty convincing argument that if you really want true privacy on the web, then you have to actually have applications that are built on different business models that never need to steal your data. They don't actually need your identity at all. They just want you to use them, right? They're opaque to the kind of wallet that connects. They don't care if you're a user or not. They just care that you're signing transactions. And that means that there's some inherent alignment between Web3 and building true privacy and devices that are really, really try to keep your data locked down. So that was really kind of the motivation, the vision for it. And it's a big risk, like building a phone, a massive undertaking. But a lot easier now than 5 years ago, I would say. I was there when like Windows Metro, I worked on, helped bring up that device, helped bring up the Amazon Fire, whole bunch of other devices that you've never heard of. and a lot of those things failed because we weren't as good at building phones back then. Like it took a lot more people and energy. Now, like Awesome is maybe 40 people, and we have like less than 10 engineers working on the software side. So it's a much, much smaller investment. And two, there is like an actual opportunity for Web3. Like the biggest problem with mobile and Web3 right now is, outside of the security of the seed phrases, is that the app stores just don't work with Web3. Like you have a user-generated, true digitally owned item that's on sale in Magic Eden. You like Magic Eden can't charge 30% more to a mobile user for that NFT, nor can they eat the 30% fee, because Magic Eden doesn't own that content. And this is like the thing that's breaking the models for the Web2 models. Like the content is actually owned by the users, right? It's not like renting a movie from Amazon where they say own, but you don't actually own it. You're renting it forever, maybe, if you're lucky. But this true idea of true digital ownership means that you have to treat digital items like you do physical items. And that's just not how those app stores are designed. So if we can get this device to 50,000 like Web3 users, that's actually a better distribution channel to Web3 devs than the big app stores with hundreds of millions of users. This is something that most folks don't realize, but the number of people that actually use Web3 right now, people say there's 400 crypto people, like users or whatever, they mean holders. That's not actual users. The number of people that sign transactions across all chains combined is under 10 million on a monthly basis. And that's a very small number. That's like internet 1994, the number of people that knew what a web link was and knew how to click on it and that it took them to a different website, that was about 10 million.
So if we look at when application marketplaces have been created and then been successful, you tend to get a combination of being able to bring a lot of the talented devs and some early user cases. And you tend to get, if the organization has the, you know, the coffers, the funds, the appetite, their own products being launched as well. What type of combination are you doing there? How are you going to make sure that this is as successful as possible?
Yeah, we have a pretty awesome developer track. I think our hackathons and hacker houses have been probably like the best in the industry. Our hackathons get more people building than like Google's or even like the big tech ones. So we are actually, I think, have an awesome developer ecosystem, and we are in a rapidly growing market. Web3, like, if I didn't believe that there's going to be within 5 years, 100 million people that are signing transactions, I wouldn't be working on this, right? So assuming that we're going to go from 10 to 100 million in the next 5 years, the thing that we really need to focus on is onboarding these devs to build awesome applications for these devices. And when I see an app that somebody buys the phone because of this app, this is where I feel like I can do a victory lap. It means that there's now a Web3 use case that's not available anywhere else except in this new environment, new way to do digital content, new way to distribute value to users and creators and all that. This is what I think would be like the really breakthrough case. And it can happen with like 10, 20,000 people, but that would be enough to really show that that's a model that works. And this is what, then we can really scale it out to consumers.
I think this takes us on to venture quite nicely, to actually think through, well, what could the next user cases be? Just before I do that, have you seen, do you suspect that the other platforms are going to come after this mobile concept at pace now as well?
I think Polygon announced some collaborations with some other OEMs, but that's a bit different. Like, I mean, I don't want to speak for them. Like, our work with Awesome is that we're kind of joint at the hip. Like, our engineering team and theirs are like deeply involved, and the software that we're building on its own is like an awesome piece of technology that can be plugged into any OEM device, any Android device. So this is like, for folks just to have an idea, this is a standard Android device, runs all the Android applications you expect, all the Google stuff works. There's a Google Play Store there, Google Pay, everything. But there's also this additional piece that enables secure key signing and recovery, as well as a decentralized app store. And some of the things that enables are like pretty subtle, but pretty obvious. Like, if you ever use the Web3 app and you click Wallet Connect and there's 50 different wallets, that goes away because if the operating system knows what your keys are, the apps can automatically connect, right? Like, you kind of make a lot of these UX things way more seamless and way easier and kind of simpler. So yeah, like, what I want, the kind of example MVP, what I want is that, like, when I go to my coffee shop and I pay for like my coffee, I can bring up Phantom and pay with a thumbprint. And behind the scenes, the signing and the conversion of the tokens to like credit card numbers and all that stuff is taken care of for you. So if we can build that, then all the pieces that we need for like Web3 adoption and mobile are proven out.
Amazing. And then with the venture fund, I don't know how involved you are with that.
I a little bit. So I do a lot of the technical due diligence still, and like talk to teams, talk to founders.
What's the thesis?
It's mostly founder driven. Like, I think the space is still so early. There's no true proven business models besides, I think, like NFT marketplace. And we really just look for people that are like, have like, you know, it's really hard to tell, but like, do they have that like fire in their eyes and like that ambition to go build through the bear market and like build something awesome?
So, you know, if we set the kind of horizon, however far you want, really, I mean, I definitely want to hear what the Hollywood kind of 10-year version is, a billion users, and, you know, Solana is the universe. But the next, if you did think through what one or two of the next unit user cases were to be beyond NFTs, and think what you might be funding beyond, you know, insanely amazing, passionate founders who can build. What do you hope? What do you hope those might be, Anatoly?
This is like the hardest thing to predict. Because I can say like the boring stuff, payments and like things like that. But I think a lot of these ideas are very like skeuomorphic. You're trying to take what exists in the real world and then reapply it to this new world. And I think few of those will succeed, but it's really, really unpredictable. What I hope is that like there is actually like some transformative social networks that are built on top of Web3 that are privacy based and don't have any incentives to steal anyone's data. I think that could be just really, really different than how we use the web today. And I don't think those are probably going to be the things that make the most money or even be like financially the most lucrative to do. But I think the way that they might have the most impact on our day-to-day like kind of web usage.
Yeah, and then just to finish, because we've taken a lot of your valuable time, I think two things. There's a big update technically about to drop. Can you talk the audience through that on the chain?
So 1.11 update that's coming up. So one of the coolest things that we built over the last 6 months when dealing with congestion is fee markets. And this is something that had we not made the mistakes that we did, we would have never figured out what the right solution is. And it's kind of obvious in retrospect. So when you see these massive fee spikes in Ethereum, yeah, it's because you have something like a Bored Apes airdrop plus financial liquidations happening at the same time. And they're all competing for the same block space, because the way Ethereum works is that you have one giant state machine and every transaction locks the entire thing. There's no parallel processing. So you're pricing everything as a single resource. And whenever you have two things competing for that resource, even though they're totally separate things, they'll start outbidding each other because it's so important that each one reliably gets into the block. And Solana is quite different. It has parallelism, it has isolation. And had we not seen these effects on our system, we wouldn't have figured out that the best way to deal with this is actually to isolate these fee markets. That if you have a NFT drop, that fees only go up for that one part of the state, and things like liquidations and et cetera, and all these other things can have their own separate auctions that are happening concurrently. And this was something that took us 3-4 months to build. All the features line in 1.10 and what's enabling in 1.11, besides a bunch of performance optimizations, is finally the messaging layer update to Quick, which is a awesome protocol built by Google for high performance like internet communication. So once 11 rolls out, I think we should see the kind of performance that you see on the network today just be the standard. So just more reliable and more stable.
Fantastic. And then just lastly, if you want to kind of give the Hollywood in, you know, 10 years time, what do you hope that Solana becomes?
I hope it's like Linux. Like, I hope that the software, the technology grows and becomes so used and has so many people contributing to it that you kind of think of it as this almost public good. So that would be awesome to me.
Amazing. And when you know, sometimes it sounds like you've been quite confident in your past. You're like, you know, I think I've got this eureka moment. There's going to be a lot of traction, but you're a wise man these days, and know there's always iterations and challenges. Do you sit here now confident that vision's going to happen?
A lot more confident now, honestly, than 2 years ago. I would say that, like, I think it's pretty clear that we're in the right track for like the kind of technology that we're building, and I think crypto is on the right track of like slowly but surely like kind of replacing all the parts of the world that haven't been automated with software.
Absolutely love it, Anatoly. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.